So it's my pleasure to introduce Jennifer Mather, who's a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Lethbridge. So she does leading research on the cognitive capacities and psychological properties of octopuses and other cephalopods, including their problem-solving abilities, their personalities, their playfulness, and their consciousness. And she also works toward educating the general public about the cognitive sophistication of these and other invertebrates and its ethical significance. Please welcome Jennifer. Thank you. Whose talk is held, Why Might Minds Converge, the Case of the Octopus. Oh, it's different. No. The Evolution of Cephalopod Intelligence, a dead end. Dead end?
Right. Thank you for being here, for inviting me to come. It's fascinating for me because, generally speaking, when people talk about cognition, it's like, oh, yeah, the octopuses. And with the cephalopod people, when they talk about, oh, there's that cognition stuff. So in some ways, I'm at an intersection of neglect. And in some ways, I think there's a possibility that the cephalopods are at a dead end. This isn't what I did in my abstract, but when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, I think I'm going to try this. So let's see. And I should mention, because probably you don't necessarily know, they have a relatively large brain, not as big as a brain-body ratio as mammals and birds, but larger than many, many other animals. They have the ability to play. They use tools. They have very distinct personalities. Okay? So there is a lot about them that turns out to be very interesting in terms of behavioral complexity. But interestingly enough, while they have this large brain, for octopuses, 3/5 of the neurons are in the arms. So they have a much bigger nervous system than brain. And what that means is that they have diffuse control of behavior. And we don't really know how to understand a nervous system with this kind of diffusion. We really don't. I'm interested in listening to our speaker about insects because the insects, of course, have the same lack of one single centralized brain area. And I don't know whether that's a positive or a negative for the development of cognitive complexity. We just know that that's the way it is. Okay? A reporter asked me the other day, he said, well, surely octopuses are very intelligent because they have such wonderful manipulative capacity. And I thought, oh, no, I don't think so. And of course, Laurie's got the cetaceans that don't have particularly good physical manipulative capacity and have other ways to solve cognitive problems. Another problem with this is that because the arms have 3/5 of the neurons of the nervous system, they have a great deal of local control. And we are still trying to understand, and we do not yet know, to what extent this local control means that they're not using intelligence to solve manipulative problems. We just don't know exactly how much of the control of behavior is central and how much is simply allocated to the arms. I should explain, by the way, if you cut off an octopus arm, it will, if you've got a moist surface, it'll walk on its suckers down the moist surface. There's a rumor that I've never seen that if you take a detached arm and you move and you put something like a small piece of food at the tip of it, it will move the piece of food from sucker to sucker up to the mouth that isn't there. Okay. So there is a great deal of peripheral control, and we don't know enough about what that means. And the other thing that the cephalopods have that people use for an argument for their intelligence, quite reasonably, I think, is the skin display system. Is this a pointer? No, it's a timer. Well, I'll just open it. Nevertheless, I could go stand here. They have chromatophores of 3 different colors, black, brown, red, orange, yellow, and below them they have reflecting cells, leucophores and iridophores, that reflect color in the blue-green range or simply reflect all colors. These chromatophores are neurally controlled. Every single chromatophore is an elastic sac with muscles pulling it out. And the leucophores turn out to be responsive to modulatory control from neurotransmitters, which we don't know a lot about. The result is that an octopus or a cuttlefish or a squid can change the pattern on the skin within 20 milliseconds and probably within 20 millimeters. We're not sure just how fine control they can make. So it was Moynihan who said that he thought that octopuses, and actually said squid, could make a visual language on their skin. And there's no doubt they have the modulatory capacity. On the other hand, they tend to use this skin appearance for camouflage. Have you figured out where the octopus is? They're wonderful at camouflage. The cuttlefish are just as good as the octopuses, and the squid are fairly good. Not as good, okay? So there's absolutely no doubt they're using this fine modulation for camouflage, and we think that was the basic way that they were using this. But I did study squid, and this is Cepiotuthis cepioidea, who were in the Caribbean. And I was particularly interested in this idea with the squid because the squid has some fairly distinct patterns, okay? And that and Moynihan said perhaps the accessories to the patterns were changing the meaning of the patterns. But it turns out that the squid are probably using a fairly limited repertoire because they don't use this so much for camouflage, but they use it for sexual signals. That's camouflage. For obvious reasons, we call that one plaid, and that's in small animals. Okay. And this is a line, that's small animals, and there's another one in plaid. They also use, for camouflage, they also use position of the arms, which is wonderful. They're really interesting. This is actually what you would see in a squid in the daytime. And you can tell individuals by the pattern of these dots here, the males on the fins, and you can figure out the pattern of the dots on the dorsal surface of the mantle. So we were able to do individual ID, which is fascinating. Okay, so this is a male in stripe and a female in saddle. It's not a very good saddle because the saddle should be larger. And this is a male in the agonistic zebra. I didn't call it a zebra, it's a particularly terrible zebra. And here's a squid in two-dot dynatic, which seems to be a startled response. This is another male-female. And this is a male in lateral silver. He's guarding a female and repelling other males with his signal. Okay. So this is... And they can do a signal, this is wonderful, they can do one signal on one side of their body and another on the other. I can't do that. So on this side, towards the female, he's showing his kinder, gentler colors. And then this side, towards the other males, he's saying, bug off, go away, get lost, this is mine. Okay. But they are fairly stereotyped signals. And if you think about it, of course they're going to be fairly stereotyped because they're sexual signals. They have to be. They have to be easily recognized. Now, the one signal that's still in some ways fairly stereotyped and yet is variable is the agonistic display. It's made by males about 95% of the time to other males. Never made by males to females. Never made female to female. The other 5% of the time, it's made by females to males. Okay. And I have to apologize. I've never actually published this in detail. I mean, fairly generalized stuff. I worked out a way to quantify the zebra by saying, okay, it can be on a dark background. By the way, that's a piece of zebra just there on half the arms. That's about as little as they can make. This is very small annoyance. Or it can be on the mantle and the arms. This is actually a visual contest. So the male below is spreading the arms and they actually spread them wider than that and is white on background. And the male above is brown and is not spreading the arms. That's a ritualized contest. And when I first saw these, I was really quite astonished because I realized that The one underneath did the white and the widespread, and the one above did the brown and the small spread. And I thought, well, how do they know? And so the next year when we were out in Bonaire, which is where I was studying him, I watched, and they'd come up together and they'd jockey for the under position. And when the one was in the under position, it would give the much more intense seabird. When the one was in the over position, it would do the much less intense. And I did watch one contest where they came up like this and then like this and all that. And this guy did the white and they switched spots. Okay. So this is a grading display and a very sophisticated grading, and I thought about that. But in terms of, oh, and there's another thing that was interesting. Moynihan said that there were other signals in the periphery, and here's brown on the edge of the fin. And somewhere okay. Here's the fin base stripe. So I looked at the correlation between the central display, which is a zebra, and all the peripheral displays, and in fact, the more intense the central zebra, the more likely there is to be brown here. So it's a quantitative thing, okay, which is what Shelley Adamo found for cuttlefish displays. And there was absolutely no correlation between that and this basic zebra stripe. Let's see if this will work. Yes. That's the same stripe that's the bear in the sexual display. So I strongly suspect that that is simply on a male. It's a signal of maleness. Okay. It doesn't follow that this is a language. The displays that they are making to one another, in fact, are signaling internal state. I have not seen any evidence of any display signaling as you would find in a language, you know, like the trees are beautiful out there, so I'm indicating something about the external environment, not about me. Okay, so it's a very interesting display, it's a very complex display, but I haven't seen any sign that it would be anything like a language. Though it's interesting to think about because that, so the use of skin displays in many purposes. This is a startle display. And I looked at that in squid, signaling to start to approaching fish, and they sometimes vary the position of the dots, and the dot is towards the fish. Okay, so they are displaying startle to the fish. So that they do use this display for many purposes, but I haven't seen any sign that it's a language. So in some sense, I think that's a dead end in terms of the development of complex intelligence. Okay. The other reason that I think that cephalopods have a limitation on their intelligence is they are a very short lifespan. The biggest possible octopus, which is Dauphine, lives somewhere between 2 and 4 years. The ones that I've been studying, the vulgaris, it's about 1.5 years. And many of them, in fact, most of them live between 6 months and 1 year. And one of the paradoxes that the people in my area of learning ask is, why should an animal that lives such a short time develop intelligence? Okay. And I think the answer to that, to some extent, is that it's a very, very demanding environment that they live in. Now, the cephalopods evolved from the mollusks. All the mollusks have protective shells of one kind or another. But in the process, the coleoid cephalopods, which is most of the modern cephalopods, lost the shell during evolution. And someone described them as simply a very nice package of unprotected protein out there. Okay. Now, if you live in the coral reef environment, you live in the most complex environment in the planet. People are fond of saying, oh, you know, the jungle, it's a most complicated environment, and the monkeys live in it, and they have such difficulty with dealing with a changing and complex environment. But the coral reef's much, much more complex. Anything that can find them will eat octopuses, squid, and cuttlefish. Okay. They must find ways to invade a complex of predators. They have to have response to both varied and varying environment. Let's see if I got this next. In addition, They have to forage in a complex environment. They have to, and by the way, I want to say a word about visual systems here, because I forgot to mention that the eye of the octopus and the squid and the cuttlefish is in fact an excellent example of physical convergent evolution with the eye of the mammal. The only thing that's different is that mammals have the neurons coming out of the front of the retina, and it has to go back through the retina to the brain, which is why we have a blind spot. And the cephalopods have the intelligence, if you like to put it that way, of having it come out the back. Okay. But just because, and I think I'll just mention this because we've been talking about this already, thank you, Laurie, which is just because we have eyes and they have eyes doesn't mean that we're using the same structure in the same way. Okay. Octopuses, in particular, forage this way that you see. A lot of people have studied their learning. It's a real tribute to the animals, because a lot of people have studied their learning by dropping little pieces of food in through the water, and they pick them up and go, thank you, yes. But food doesn't lie around waiting for you. In the marine environment in particular, anything that was up in the surface would be gone. There's a whole lot of scavengers and predators. So octopuses aren't using vision for finding food. Now that's a little bit unfair, because I think I'd have to say that they're using the vision to find likely areas in which to find food. Okay? And having gone to an area that they have probably learned is likely to have food, they're then sticking these arms down in through holes and crevices and under rocks, doing chemotactile foraging. So I think that's something that we have to think about, and in fact I think we probably said this with brains. Just because the structure sort of looks the same doesn't mean you're using it in the same way. And what comes out with that is that I've done a study, and I haven't published it yet, I'm sorry, that proves that they don't do mirror self-recognition. And yet, there's someone who has just begun to look at chemical cues, and they actually excised arms and presented them to octopuses, and they excised their own arm, pretty barbaric, and they excised the arm of other animals, and they found that the animals would not grasp and catch and bring to their mouth their own arm, but they would for the arms of other animals. So clearly there's probably some chemical self-recognition. And I think we don't look enough at the use of chemical cues, which is primary in the animal kingdom. We're visual. We tend to take it for granted not only that other animals are also visual, but given that they have vision, that they use it in the same way that we do. And I think that this is not going to get us where we want to go. Okay. So I think it's this foraging for many different kinds of food, this living in complex, varying environments, that is the pressure towards these animals having developed cognition. Okay? And it's interesting, because one of the things that I noticed a long time ago when I first went out and studied octopuses is that they have wind switch foraging. Okay? And it makes complete sense when you think about it in terms of where you're going to find the food. If there's a crab under the rock there and you find it, the next day there's not going to be another crab there. It doesn't work that way. If it's shelter, a crab will eventually find it, but it's no use going and looking the next day because it's not going to be there. And what I found, and I should have done a diagram of this, if an octopus has a central home and it goes out hunting in this general area and comes back to the home, okay, the next day it'll go out to another area. And the next day it'll go out to another area. Okay? So it's doing wind switch foraging, which makes sense. In the long run, and I was just talking to somebody about this, a colleague of mine has been watching octopuses as well, and she has not quantified this, but she said she thinks that early in their lifespan, They don't have a sense of where is a good place to go find food. But I noticed very clearly when I was doing the observational study that, you know, if there was flat rock there, they'd go just swim over it, and they'd settle and move their arms down along a crack, or they'd go over, and they have a wonderful maneuver called web over, where they surround a rock with their arms and the web in between, and then they'd feel underneath to see what they'd find. Okay? And they stay for, this particular species of vulgaris, they'd stay in the same place for about 10 days. So I think they're doing food finding at several different levels, at the wind switch, at this level of knowing where to find food, this level of the wind switch foraging, and this level of it's time to move on, the general feedback about food I'm getting isn't very good. Okay. So I think what this has developed evolutionarily is an animal with a very, very high pressure for exploration. Now, I think this is something that we neglect. We don't understand exploration. It's not surprising we don't understand exploration. It's easy to put an animal out here and give it food over here and watch it go here, or watch them, you know, in relationships with one another. But it's Renner that talked about exploration, and he said, you know, we take it for granted. If you put an octopus into a confined area, it will spend a couple of hours completely exploring it. And it turns out, by the way, that if you put a rat in a maze and you give it no food reward, it will go around exploring. And indeed, then when you want to see what the rat has learned about the maze, it turns out it's learned a lot about the maze. Okay. So I think the octopus has a very high pressure, because of this necessity to find food, to do a lot of exploration to understand its environment. It's got a lot of pressure to do wind switch foraging because it's not going to find food, as I said, in the same place in the next 2 hours or so. And I did a study on octopus personality, and I'm trying, and I haven't yet, but I'm trying to link it to the foraging strategies. It didn't work. I went to the island of Morea to try to do this, which is, you know, terribly difficult and painful. And it didn't work, partly, I think, because we didn't find enough animals, and partly because I suspect that also very, very highly depended upon the variety of habitats and where they can find food. Okay. But individuals, there's so much to tell you in so little time. If you take a population that's in a varied environment, right, and you track what individuals are eating, then you find that some of them are generalists and some of them are specialists. And I think they're probably specialists because of the learning. I think probably, you know, we had one that took immature conch shells, and we'd go one day and they'd have a conch shell discarded with a hole in it where they'd drilled it so they could poison it and weaken it. And we'd come back the next day and they'd have another conch. And there was another that had found individual pinna. They're bivalves, but they stick up from the water. They're really, really easy to see. And it had discovered them, and one day there was a pinna, and the next day there were two pinna. On the other hand, there was another one that was higher up in the near shore that had, you know, six species of crabs and five species of snails. So I think that the individual has a very great deal of pressure to learn about the immediate environment. And I think that this is, and I haven't proven this, mitigated by personality. So I think that they have very, very different reactions within the population. And this kind of thing makes me very wary about saying we think that the raven does this or the cetacean does this, because there is so much of a range of variation. Thank you, Laurie, for nodding. Now, okay, cephalopods have, in addition to a short life, very simple or very trivial social groupings. Octopuses are solitary unless they're crowded, and then they generate a dominance hierarchy. Cuttlefish are generally solitary, but they gather for mating. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to go out and study the squid, because they are actually in small, permanent groups. Okay. But, oh, well, this is another thing. They have no guidance from parents. They have no guidance from conspecifics. This is a female octopus. Whoops, wrong one. Uh-oh. What can I get back? Okay, so that, while you're trying, that's a female octopus brooding eggs. Octopuses, females, brood eggs until the eggs hatch, and then they die. You want to run all the way
to the beginning?
Cuttlefish and squid gather for mating, generate eggs, usually hide eggs, and then they die. So there is no overlap of generations. Okay, there's no parental care. And because the young disperse widely in the ocean, they are not ever near related individuals. Okay, so you have the paradox of this intelligent animal.
There you go.
I want to go one back. Right. You have this intelligent animal with wide dispersion, no parental care, hardly any parental care, no parental child care. And the other thing that we find of the cephalopods is they're cannibals. So they have to be the ultimate individuals because you can't trust anybody else. Now, what I did actually think about is, in the long run, what would have to change before we would find the cephalopods be the kind of animals that mammals and birds are? There are octopuses with big eggs. So Octopus jubini, for instance, has maximum of 100, maybe 40 or 50 is a mean. And they have limited dispersal. If octopuses evolved more to be limited dispersal, they would be more likely to live near related individuals. Okay. But another important thing is this display system, because the display system of the cephalopods is so good that they could say anything they wanted, if they wanted to. I just have the suspicion that they haven't found something important to say. And my answer would be, give them a few millennia and let's see what we can do. Okay, thank you.